From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Latinos who served in the Vietnam War finally get their stories told on stage. Then playwright Jose Rivera talks about how an ad in Harper's Magazine 10 years ago inspired the untranslatable secrets of Nicky Corona, his new production about life after death.
I thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. It really was just the passage of time and then these personal tragedies that deepened my outlook on it.
And violinist Hilary Hahn pays homage to her early music teacher. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film, The Old Man and the Gun, directed by David Lowery and starring Robert Redford in his final on-screen performance, in select theaters Friday.
And National Geographic, presenting Free Solo, a film that follows climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream of climbing El Capitan in Yosemite National Park without a rope. Free Solo opens in theaters starting September 28th.
It's hard to quantify how many Latinos served in the military during the Vietnam War because the Pentagon identified them racially as white. And in movies, documentaries, and literature about the conflict, Latino characters are often relegated to bit parts at best. But this much is known: Chicano soldiers died in disproportionate numbers in Vietnam. Now, more than 40 years since the capture of Saigon by North Vietnamese forces, the play Ring of Red, a Barrio story, shines a spotlight on the experiences and stories of Chicano veterans. KPCC veteran affairs reporter Libby Dankman has our report.
This is for real.
We went on a transport ship and
That actually looked really nice, you guys.
I've dropped in on a rehearsal for Ring of Red, a Barrio story. Six actors are in street clothes, still sorting out blocking for the production, but they're already projecting raw emotion from the stage.
I didn't know what that sound was like. I'll never forget it. And then I hear my soldiers crying out in pain.
The play is part of a years-long effort by Associate Professor Tomas Summers Sandoval, who teaches history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College. With help from his students, Sandoval has recorded more than 50 oral histories from Chicano Vietnam War veterans, mostly from Southern California. Actors were cast to translate the vets' experiences into what he calls a testimonial-style play.
We follow their lives through their own storytelling from beginning to end, from childhood into basic training or boot camp and into Vietnam, and then the struggles that they experienced when they came back home.
The title, Ring of Red, refers to the clay ring that lingered in the bathtub of one Chicano soldier after he returned from Vietnam, a residue from the war he couldn't wash off. At the time they served, Latino members of the U.S. military were counted together with white troops in official documents. There was no separate ethnicity category, so it's tough to know exactly how many Chicanos went to war.
And so, in just a demographic way, it's sort of a hidden history.
The best estimate shows Latinos made up an outsized number of casualties in Vietnam compared to their share of the overall population. But Sandoval says the lack of data means these vets are often overlooked, absent from both the official record and the popular culture that shapes our collective understanding of Vietnam. He started writing a book on the subject, and he's also using the theater to bring the Chicano community's stories to life.
Anytime that I can take people's stories and put them in front of folks without this voice of a professor telling them what it all means, that's a good thing.
Veterans inspired the play, and they're also part of the cast. Diana Shield, who served in the Marines for 4 years, plays the wife of a Vietnam vet in Ring of Red, but it's the men's experiences returning from war that resonate with her.
Adapting to the civilian part of life after 4 years, I was like shocked. So hearing the men in the story talk about their PTSD, even though they didn't know it was PTSD, that's how it was for me.
Shield's mom is from Guatemala and her dad is from Mexico. She says it's vital for Chicano voices to be reviving their own Vietnam experiences when they've often been made out to be outsiders to American history.
I think we need to be telling our stories because we're patriotic too. That's why my mom and my dad came here, you know. They wanted better future for their children. That's what I want for my children.
Within the play, Sandoval wants to make clear Chicanos didn't have one unified Vietnam experience. As the war split Americans down ideological lines, the emerging Chicano movement in L.A. linked Vietnam to the struggle for civil rights.
I started to notice the stuff where I live. I mean, how come all the Mexicans lived in the same place? And how come the cops still hassle us and call us greasers?
The characters in Sandoval's play are conflicted about the war. But like young Americans in every community, they often end up enlisting out of patriotism or a lack of economic opportunity. Some are simply caught up in the draft. That was the case for Tomas Sandoval Sr., Professor Sandoval's father, who was drafted in 1969.
For me, I was a combat infantryman. Yeah, so I was fighting the enemy, so to speak.
After basic training, Sandoval deployed to Vietnam and got assigned KP duty on his first night in the country. KP, also known as kitchen police.
Wash the pots, wash the dishes, do all that kind of stuff, right?
Soon he's introduced to the mess sergeant.
And then he happens to be named Chavez. And the first thing he asked me was, where are you from? Sandoval, Los Angeles. And he says, do you know Snappy Martinez? Now, come on. There's got to be, 3-4 million people in Los Angeles? But I knew him.
After 30 years working in telecommunications, the elder Sandoval has found a second career, acting in local theater, commercials, and picking up work as an extra. He's the only veteran who both contributed an oral history to the project and joined the cast, though a fellow actor delivers this story.
And here I am, thousands of miles away, and this guy asked me if I know Snappy. I said, yeah, we named him that. I didn't have to work at all that night. He gave me a steak, we had some beers, we even looked at pictures of him and Snappy. What are the odds?
Professor Sandoval has been working on his oral history project for 7 years. But he says today's political context makes the work all the more relevant.
You don't have to look very hard to see the way that Latinos in general are vilified inside of a lot of our popular discourse, a lot of our political discourse. And these kinds of stories are great reminders of how integrated we've been in this country's history. And really, in essence, how American generations of us have been and become.
For The Frame, I'm Libby Denkman.
Ring of Red, a Barrio Story, is at the Bootleg Theater in Los Angeles through September 30th. And if you want to learn more about this subject, check out the documentary titled On Two Fronts, Latinos and Vietnam. You can find it at pbs.org. Coming up, a new play travels to the afterlife in order to deliver a message, literally and figuratively.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film, The Old Man and the Gun. Robert Redford stars in his final on-screen performance with Casey Affleck, Danny Glover, Tom Waits, and Sissy Spacek in select theaters Friday.
And by National Geographic, presenting Free Solo, from the directors of Meru, hailed by critics as one of the most arresting documentaries of the year and a stunning real-world thriller, Free Solo is the breathtaking portrait of climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream, climbing the face of the world's most famous rock, the 3,200-foot El Capitan in Yosemite National Park, without a rope. Free Solo is in theaters starting September 28th.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The playwright Moss Hart once derisively said about stories that are overly preachy, if you've got a message, call Western Union. But what if you're someone who really wants to send a message and Western Union won't exactly work because the recipient is no longer among the living? That's the premise of the new play, The Untranslatable Secrets of Nikki Corona, written by Jose Rivera. It's a world premiere that just opened at the Geffen Playhouse. The play starts with a woman's suicide, and then we meet her twin, Nikki, played by Onahawa Rodriguez. She wants to contact her dead sister and enlist an agency who pairs her with a terminally ill man who will convey her note once he dies. Here's a scene from early in the play where Nikki meets the man named Orlando, played by Ricardo Chavira.
Do you think I'm the right person?
What's the right person in this situation?
Well, dying shouldn't be the only criteria. Maybe persistence? Maybe reliable?
Marin did say you had an issue with commitment.
Playwright Jose Rivera, whose credits include the movie The Motorcycle Diaries, was originally inspired to write this play when he saw an ad for a real service offering to take personal notes to loved ones in the afterlife. When his own brother died, his play started to come into sharper focus.
It was, well, you know how Harper's will print, you know, miscellaneous crazy things like lists and transcripts and things. So in this case, they printed a contract that this particular company makes everyone sign. And the contract basically was just, you know, a long list of disclaimers talking about, you know, what you would find if you died and went to the other side. And so disclaimers were like, well, we don't know what languages they speak. We don't know if they speak English. We don't know what form your body's going to take when you go there, you know, on and on. And I thought it was fascinating and thought, wow, this is a really interesting company. And I think there's a play in this. And so I don't know if that company still exists anymore, but in my play, it becomes a company called A Better Orpheus that takes people who want to send a message to a loved one on the other side and connects them to someone who is terminally ill. And you bring the two people together and one person teaches the other person a message. And when that person dies, they go to the other side to deliver it.
When you first encountered this little blurb in Harper's, I suspect you kind of thought this is kind of preposterous. And as time goes by, I wonder if your opinion about the whole concept changes and that you begin to understand on a personal level why somebody would not only create but also use a service like this.
Yeah, I thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. I mean, I thought who the hell would create a company like this? Who in the world would ever want to be a client in a company like this? But yeah, it really was just the passage of time and then these personal tragedies that deepened my outlook on it. And I thought, well, you know, we want to never let go of love. We never want to let go of the loved one that escaped our grasp and passed away, no matter how rational we might be or, you know, how scientific we may think. That desire for endless connection with the loved one is overpowering. So yeah, as I thought about it, the more it became very possible, you know. And in the play, I go to great pains to, you know, justify the logic.
One of the things that the play kind of, I think, makes a lot of people think about is what has been said and what has been unsaid. And to really kind of examine, while people are with you and people that you care about, what you tell them and what you tell them about what's important. And I'm wondering, as you're writing this play and kind of thinking about your own life, do you start making sure that you are sharing the things that are important to you with the people you care about while they're still with you?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I'm a strong believer in karma and karmic payback and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm very, very aware of trying to live a life, you know, led by truth and courage and compassion for the people I love. Because I think all bad behavior rebounds on a person. And I've always tried to, live as honestly as I can.
So much of your play is about accountability and about reconciliation and forgiveness, about admitting the things that you have done right and recognizing the things that you have done wrong in whatever form that may be. When you're thinking about those various topics, because there's a wide range of themes that you explore, especially in the second half of the play, how did you go about populating those stories? What were you thinking about the people that you thought needed to, or at least should be considering, some sort of act of redemption.
Yeah, well, you know, the play, one of the inspirations for the play is Dante's Inferno. And I'd always wanted to write a contemporary version of that. You know, Dante populated his hell with sinners. So there, you know, if you've committed the sin of gluttony or disloyalty or lust, there's a place for you in his afterlife. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to talk about sin, even though I was raised a Catholic. But I really wanted to talk about karma. So I populated the second half of the play with characters committing what I think are, you know, very painful violations of humanity. So, for instance, you know, the main character Orlando meets an old girlfriend who had fat shamed a boy at a party to the point where he cried and couldn't stop crying until he died. And so she is drinking a bathtub full of his tears. You know, it's those kinds of small interactions that I find, you know, really interesting in terms of what people have done to wrong other people. You know, the biggest thing I had to deal with was just resisting being too political. So, you know, I could have very easily, you know, had a politician who was mocking a disabled reporter, you know, in the play. But I didn't want to go that in that direction, you know.
You're not that real.
Not that real. It's too scary.
We're talking with Jose Rivera, the playwright of The Untranslatable Secrets of Nikki Corona. Part of that title, The Untranslatable Secrets, is both kind of a title and almost it feels like an admission on your part of like you're not really sure how you're going to translate this secret. What's behind the use of that word?
Yeah, I love that word. It's, you know, I think so many things are untranslatable. I think human emotion is untranslatable, and we try to read each other's emotions and try to read the looks in another person's eyes and their body language, and we don't know. We just don't know. We can guess at how other people are doing and what's on their mind, but ultimately only they know. So, yeah, in this play, you know, there's a set of twins, and one of the twins, you know, jumps off the Golden Gate Bridge in the beginning, and then her twin sister, Nikki, of the title, wants to deliver a message, but we never hear what that message is. And that's the untranslatable secret of the title of the play, Nikki's message to her deceased sister. And I honestly thought whatever I could write in terms of that secret will be such an anticlimax. It will just not justify the buildup, and that it should remain a mystery. And it's a mystery only the characters on stage know the answer to. And
well, that's my question. Does the actor actually know? Because she is playing an emotion and playing toward a goal that I wonder if it's helped by her knowing at least vaguely what it might be that she wants to say.
Yeah, I left it up to the actors because they
interesting.
They asked the same question. I said, "What, you know, make it personal. Make what would you have said, you know, to your sister if that were the case?" Everybody in the cast had close loved ones die recently. And so I didn't want to impose a solution to that problem. I wanted the cast to find it for themselves.
In writing this play, you are dealing with some very serious topics like suicide and terminal illness. And yet you're also trying to tell a story that is both kind of magical and at times is funny. So how did you figure out, and maybe it was through rehearsals with your director, Joe Bonney, and your cast, about how to strike the right tone? What was the push and pull on that equation?
Yeah, I mean, I can't resist the joke. I can't. I think humor is you know, the way to really communicate, even hard and painful subjects. You know, one of my early heroes was George Bernard Shaw, who used humor to, you know, get all his socialist ideas out there. You know, I think, you know, that for me, the art of theater is at its bottom, entertainment. And I love to blend humor with really disgusting things and, you know, low humor and high ideas. And that mixture to me is really exciting. And I think that's what makes the plays percolate. Is you never know what's coming around the corner. You just don't know where this line is going to go. And to me, that surprise of humor is a real reward for you know, hanging in there with the play.
Jose Rivera is the playwright of The Untranslatable Secrets of Nikki Corona. It's at the Geffen Playhouse through October 7th. Jose, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
Coming up on The Frame, violinist Hilary Hahn. Violinist Hilary Hahn was just 11 years old when she made her orchestral debut with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. She recorded her first album just 6 years later to great critical acclaim, even earning praise from PBS icon Fred Rogers.
Oh my, you know, that just made me feel so happy.
Yeah?
I felt like dancing.
Actually, people used to dance to music like that.
But does it make you feel happy to play like that?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It makes me feel happy. Well, I love to play, so that helps.
Now, at 38, Hahn has earned 3 Grammy Awards and is one of the most widely respected performers and interpreters of classical violin repertoire. She will be in Los Angeles this weekend performing Bach with the LA Chamber Orchestra. She also has an upcoming album of Bach for solo violin. When we spoke, Hahn talked about the influence of her first teacher, Clara Berkowitz, and when she first knew that she wanted to be a professional violinist.
I think for me, it was a matter of the more I did it, the more I connected with it. I also had a wonderful Russian teacher when I was 5 to 10, and she really helped me understand what it is to be a musician, to be an artist, to appreciate music. And I think I always idolized her. I tried to play like her. I wanted to be as good as she was when she would demonstrate for me in lessons. And the day I realized I could play something that she could play was just amazing.
A lot of people, when they think about teachers or talking about teachers, a lot of the conversation is about technique. But I'm wondering about Clara and maybe other teachers that you've had about the larger world and about artistry, and it could be visiting a museum, reading a book, the way you see yourself as a performer. What are the lessons that you have taken away from some of your teachers that weren't about technique and weren't necessarily about playing?
So she was Russian, and she'd emigrated from St. Petersburg shortly before I met her. And she had these postcards from the Hermitage Museum of different famous pieces of art. And she would show them to me. And she would tell me to go to museums and tell me to read. And I took ballet and stuff like that. And she would connect it to the music. And I don't think I put two and two together at that time. I didn't understand what going to museums had to do with playing the violin. But to this day, I really love going to museums and looking at visual art as a source of creative inspiration. I'll look at a piece of art that I really like and I'll think, what do I like about that? You know, I'll just stare at it for quite a long time. And then something in my mind is like, how can I transfer this into my playing? What can I do to give an audience the feeling that I'm getting from looking at this painting? What is it that does that for me? How can I play in a way that shows that same thing? And it's a really helpful process for me because it gets me out of a creative rut that I might be in and helps me to rethink the way that I'm communicating to an audience.
In 1997, you released your first record. It was called Hilary Hahn Plays Bach, and I want to play a little bit. It's from the fugue from his violin sonata in C major.
Thank you.
When you listen to yourself, do you notice or remember how you were playing then versus how you might play differently now?
You know, I hear all kinds of things. When I listen to that little bit of the recording, I'm hearing the acoustic of the room. I'm remembering various times I've played it. I'm thinking about the last time I played that fugue, what it felt like. And I can't just listen passively, especially when it's a recording that I made. I remember everything about it. And that was that day, and I might play it differently the very next day, just as I might play it differently today. It's like, you know, you hear someone talking 20 years ago and you hear them now, the voice is kind of the same. They might be saying different things. They might be using a different part of their voice, but it's still the same voice, still the same person.
That fugue goes on for more than 11 minutes, and there are long, really dense pieces of music. And I wonder about your approach to memorizing music. How would you define the way that you start thinking about internalizing a piece of music in your own mind?
I have a whole method of analyzing the music. If I'm learning something new, I kind of break it down by phrase, and I have certain colors of marker. I learned this from Mrs. Berkovich, and I made it my own system eventually, but I have certain colors of marker for certain parts of the music, and then when it's a theme that comes back, I use the same color. So every page looks different to me, and I have a very visual memory, so that really helps me differentiate one page from the next. So, you know, I think I've developed a way of memorizing that's part muscle memory, part visual memory, part analysis of the musical structure. And inevitably, in a performance, your mind is in a very different state than it is in a practice session. So if you have multiple approaches to memorizing, one of them will kick in at any given time on stage. You just don't know which one. There are definitely moments where I'm playing something I've played for years and years and years, and all of a sudden I can't remember what the next note is just because I've always taken it for granted. I never thought about what the next note is, and suddenly I have this moment of doubt. Like, if you've been spelling the same word for years and then you look at it, like the other day I looked at the word granola and I was like, oh, that's a funny made-up word. And then I realized, no, that's a thing that exists that I've been eating for years.
Hilary Hahn will be performing Bach with the LA Chamber Orchestra on September 29th and 30th. Hilary, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. You can find The Frame wherever great podcasts are found. You can also read our stories on LAist.com. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.